You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Okay, boys, now we've got on the line from the United Kingdom a, well, not a controversial man, but a man who's a very eminent doctor over...
I'd call him controversial.
Well, you'll just wait a minute, Don, please. We'll just say who he is to start with. His name is Dr. Asim Malhotra, and he is an Indian-born British cardiologist. He studied medicine at the University of Edinburgh. He has been described as a highly regarded health expert. He's an anti-obesity expert. He's a public speaker on public health, of course. He has been he has seen unspeakable suffering caused by diet-related issues. He claimed, this is what it said in the blurb that I read about him, claimed his mother's death was primarily caused by... she caused her premature and painful vegetarian diet. He might clarify what I mean by that. He is a critic of medical profession over-prescribing things to people, to patients. He's received accolades for his book on called Food Hero, which was a children's food campaign. He's the author of the controversial... Pioppi diet, which is a Mediterranean diet. He's extremely interested in the theories on COVID-19 and diet. He has a huge interest in the COVID vaccine and the controversy about that. And that's one of the reasons we're speaking to him. And if I could just say, in welcoming Dr. Asim Malhotra, could I say that we suffered here in Victoria probably the world's greatest antisocial and pathological shutdown during the COVID 2 years here, and we were the news of the world saying how stringent and ridiculous our lockdown laws were. He might have something to say to that. So he's just finished a tour of Australia speaking about COVID. So with that very ham-fisted introduction, Dr. Asim Malhotra, welcome to You Cannot Be Serious.
It's great to speak to you. And before we start, I need to pass on some regards from two Australian public figures that have become friends of mine recently who love your work. One is Andrew Bogut, who you may know, the Australian basketball player, played in the NBA. And the other one is a friend of mine, Holly Candy, formerly known as Holly Valance, who was a Neighbours star and a singer.
Yeah, I know. Well, both those people, both great people. So we may as well jump right in. We would like to speak about your the more controversial things you've said about diet and health and all that. But you have been, I think, out here in Australia recently speaking about COVID and the vaccine and its maybe dangers and its untested quality of what we've been receiving. Is that vaguely right?
Absolutely, mate. I mean, first and foremost, who I am is I qualified as a doctor in 2001. I'm a practicing cardiologist. My focus, and I think this should be, and hopefully is the focus of every healthcare professional, is to help improve patient outcomes. And that means managing risks of disease, treating illness and relieving suffering. And to do that, I use when I start my lectures, I just start with a very simple elegant framework that I think most people should we would like to know about, called the evidence-based medicine triad. So if we want to improve our patients' health, we use our experience as doctors, the best available evidence on a particular treatment, or whether it's a lifestyle intervention, whether it's surgery, whether it's organizing a test. And then the most important of all of those three, Sam, is taking into consideration individual patient preferences and values. It's called informed consent. If that is being adhered to, then we have the best opportunity in medicine to maximize patients' outcomes, improve their health. But if there's something wrong with any of those three components, either your clinical knowledge is incomplete or the evidence you're using to make clinical decisions is corrupted, and that we'll get onto that, by commercial influence, or you're not actually taking into consideration patient preferences and values, then you're not going to maximize, you know, people's health. And for me, if we start from that place, everything I've been doing as a campaigner and activist over 10 years in the public eye around obesity and too much medicine, it starts to make sense. So I'm a root cause analysis guy. I am purely dedicated to the truth and improving patients' health. And anything that I feel is detrimental to their health, especially around medical misinformation, I will speak out about it. And that's what I've been doing for many, many years.
Would you just, in a nutshell, say that diet and obesity were the main causes of this of contracting COVID? Or is that the main reason why people went down with the malady? Or is that too simplistic to say that?
No, it's a great point, Sam. So I think once you exclude the very elderly, and just let's emphasize that certainly early on in the pandemic for the elderly and the vulnerable, certainly the original strain of the virus was particularly bad. But even despite that, and it's important to remind people this, you know, the average age of death for people from COVID was around 81 or 82. Certainly, you know, the initial figures that came through from Italy and China suggested that was the average age of death. But now, having looked at all of, you know, we've gone, a few years through this, and when you reflect back, 90% of the deaths from COVID around the world happened in countries where more than half the population were overweight or obese. So I, very early on in the pandemic, sort of March 2020, had realized there was a link between diet and excess weight and COVID, poor COVID outcomes. And then I started, you know, making noise about it. And in the end, you know, I wrote some articles, I published in medical journals. I came out publicly and said that Boris Johnson, our prime minister, likely got sick and got admitted to hospital because of his weight. That was featured as a front page article I'd written on the for the Telegraph newspaper. It became a big news story, BBC, you know, ITV, all that kind of stuff over here. And then the Secretary for Health, Matt Hancock, at the time, contacted me and asked me to advise him on the links between obesity and COVID. And I've written about that. I've written a book about that as well. So you're absolutely right, 100%. A huge relationship between poor diet and adverse outcomes from COVID.
Critical thinkers these days are being accused of, as being conspiracy theorists just because they have a different point of view from other people in the medical profession. Do you fit into that category? Do you think a lot of what you say about various things, including the vaccine and the COVID pandemic, do you think that just because you have a different opinion to other people that you are considered to be a conspiracy theorist rather than be a critical thinker about it?
Yeah, sure. Great question, Sam. So on a personal note, conspiracies occasionally become true. But when I've analyzed where we are now with our healthcare system failure, and we'll get onto the discussion about the vaccine, I've said this is not a conspiracy. This is structural failures. This is unchecked, both visible and invisible power by multinational corporations over the many years, such as Big Food, Big Pharma, where they are controlling the narrative purely for the purposes of making money. And that ultimately means people have less access to the truth, the suppression of free speech, and it's an attack on democracy. So that's where I come from. Now, if people want to label me a conspiracy theorist, they'll find it very difficult to do that because I've never said there's a conspiracy. But of course, you know, when you are taking on these big, powerful vested interests, Sam, and I did this even, you know, I was considered the lead campaigner that highlighted the harms of excess sugar consumption in the UK. And I was considered the main influencer behind bringing about a sugary drinks tax in the UK. And one of the articles I wrote with two very eminent scientists, one's a public health professor in New Zealand and the other is a professor of pediatrics in America, Robert Lustig, who's kind of the sugar guru. The title of the article was "The Science on Sugar Alone is Insufficient. Opposition from Powerful Vested Interests Needs to be Overcome." So the truth, getting the truth out there has become more and more difficult when it comes to health because a lot of people who are controlling information that people receive through even their doctor, through medical guidelines, through the media, are purely motivated by making money. And often, Sam, what they do in that process, and I'm not being inflammatory here, I'll tell you the reason, they behave in psychopathic ways as legal entities. And if you think that you've got essentially a big psychopathic entity that is having influence over your life, you can start to understand why things are going in the wrong direction.
So here's Don Scott, what doctor.
Ashim, what type of kickbacks are you experiencing? Because you've come up with a lot of things that are against the grain, and a number of British associations or societies in the medical field are kicking back against you. Can you enlighten us on anything that's being done to you to disparage what you say?
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that in a minute. But before I do that, it's very interesting you ask that question, because there's a great paper. You know, I've been in this space challenging narratives that I think are harming patients for, you know, well over 10 years. And I started with that initially, being the cardiologist that said that butter doesn't cause heart disease and eating saturated fat isn't linked to heart disease. That's where I started off in the BMJ in 2013. And that was considered very controversial at the time. And now it's been accepted. But one of the sort of great campaigners in tobacco control is actually Australian. His name is Simon Chapman, and he's from the University of Sydney. And he writes an article of his 38-year career in taking on the tobacco industry. And one of his lessons, he says, lessons for public health advocates, is grow a rhinoceros hide, as in get a thick skin. Yep. Because as soon as your work threatens an industry or an ideological cabal, you will be attacked, sometimes unrelentingly and viciously. So you have to have a thick skin. And I've gone through far worse than I've gone through recently. I'll come into the vaccine in a minute with stuff that I did around statin drugs and overprescription of statin drugs. And to be honest, and I don't want to undermine what I'm doing or the issue, but the issue about me challenging the narrative on the vaccine, for example, is a walk in the park, personally, compared to what I went through with statin. So I've already had that sort of thick skin built up. So I know what's coming my way. But also, I think one of the things that drives me is, because I'm obsessed with the truth, that gives me a veil of resilience. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, if you're getting attacked, it means you're over the target, you're making progress. One of my inspirations is Mahatma Gandhi, you know, and he was almost single-handedly got the British colonialists out of India. And he, of course, was getting attacked en route. He was jailed in South Africa initially in his campaigning. And he says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So what happened most recently is I had come out in September of last year. I'd written a paper in a peer-reviewed journal, which I spent 9 months really getting to the roots of around the COVID vaccine. And by the way, just to mention to the listeners, I was one of the first to take two doses of Pfizer. I believed in the narrative that it was safe and effective, because traditional vaccines generally are. And I went on Good Morning Britain to tackle vaccine hesitancy. I was considered that guy that would reassure the public. And then the evidence started to change in terms of what I was receiving, what was going on with patients, et cetera. And then I had to change my view. Part of it was also triggered by the fact that my poor father suffered an unexpected sudden cardiac death in the summer of 2021. So we'll come back to that, because it links to, I know Sam wants to talk about something else in relation to a very famous Australian sportsman. So we can talk about that in a second.
So you must have been a little suspicious about the vaccine when the US Congress absolved Big Pharma from any liability, from any causes that may be disputed. They gave them complete free rein of being sued for their liability.
Yes, Sam, absolutely. But the thing is, what's interesting is I didn't know about it till much later on. So a lot of what influences our decision making is, you know, is really, and this is an ongoing issue. It comes from mainstream media. So I wasn't actually aware of that until I started looking at the evidence. And when I realized there was a problem, I suddenly came across that information and thought, bloody hell, why was this not world news? Why was this not discussed, you know, in talk shows at the very beginning of the rollout, saying, you know, the vaccine manufacturers have got immunity from liability from getting sued if people are vaccine injured. You know, if that discussion had occurred, I think people would have been a lot more skeptical, and certainly, you know, the government and the medical establishment narrative couldn't also then say, as it was an emergency use authorization vaccine, you know, it was rushed through. They couldn't say with, you know, definitive certainty that this is safe and effective. But I think most people didn't know that. So you're right, Sam. Once I became aware of that, as well as many other things that were factually, you know, correct, you know, the picture started to look quite ugly. But just to finish answering the question I think Don asked me about the backlash. And I've had many examples of this in my career, but the most recent one was, I published this paper in September 2021. I said the COVID mRNA vaccine needs to be suspended, especially because of the cardiac harm. So I'm a cardiologist, so I was looking very specifically at that. I have an expertise in that area. And, you know, I hadn't managed to make most of my advocacy work over the years is I get most, almost all of my medical journal articles get in the news somehow, in the mainstream news. And that's because I make that happen, because I realize I write something because I think it's important for people to hear. But unless it hits the mainstream news, the impact of these medical journal articles is relatively minimal. So I knew that would be a big sort of coup in this process to overturn the vaccine mandate, stop the vaccine being rolled out, investigate it, et cetera. And it didn't happen. And I went into that. I outflanked. I thought, listen, I have to think outside the box here. So I managed to get into Indian press, you know, the news that the vaccine should be suspended. It was Spanish newspapers. And then I was over on Fox News. I ended up getting through by Tucker Carlson. And then it was all the, you know, the big alternative medias from people like Russell Brand to, you know, to Robert Kennedy Jr. interviewing me. And then even more recently, Joe Rogan. But in January of this year, something really interesting happened. I got a phone call from the BBC asking me to talk about new guidance that suggested we should get more healthy people taking cholesterol-lowering statin drugs to prevent heart disease. Now, that's an area of expertise I have more than anything I know, whether it's sugar or what diet stuff. I have the most expertise on cholesterol and statins, and I know that the statins in people who are low risk of heart disease have almost no benefit whatsoever, very little benefit. So I knew this was nonsense, but I said, listen, actually, we should be talking about lifestyle instead of statins for the obesity issue. And when I went on the BBC program, I immediately thought, you know what, this is a good opportunity to talk about the elephant in the room, because there are excess deaths going on around the world. We know in Australia, you've got, you know, an excess death rate of 15 to 17%. We'll come back to that. In the UK, it's been excess deaths, you know, ongoing since 2022. And clearly for me, with all the evidence we have, very clear, you know, one of the most important contributing factors, if not the main driving factor, is the COVID mRNA vaccine. So I discussed that on the BBC. That went viral, you know, almost 25 million views on Twitter. In fact, there was an article written saying that it may reach as many views as a Queen's funeral. I mean, that's how much interest there was. But there was an immediate backlash. So the Guardian and the Times newspaper went for me. It was the most read article on the Guardian website within 24 hours, basically saying BBC criticized for letting cardiologists, i.e. me, in quotes, hijack. Yep. Hijack interview was false COVID jab claim. And it was just a hit job, you know, smearing attempt. And then the Times basically did a lead article with a picture of me and an MP called Andrew Bridgen, who I basically influenced because I spoke in Parliament about it, presented my data in Parliament, and he took it on board and also said we should suspend the vaccine. And it was something along the lines of Andrew Bridgen, the MP, who was groomed by gangs of anti-vaxxers. I mean, it's so ridiculous. So that was the backlash, but that was typical. I was expecting that, and for me, that was a sign of progress, not a sign of defeat.
So, Doc, it said that at a meeting of the Association of Naturopathic Practitioners, the meeting descended into chaos because 20 of the things you put forward, they said, was unsupported by scientific evidence. What was that about? Was that one of the pushbacks of people who had a different point of view?
I'm not sure. It may well be, Sam. You may be referring to a talk I gave in London last year. So the end of last year, November, I gave a talk in London that was organized at pretty short notice, and about 1,000 people turned up. It packed this auditorium near Euston Station. And interestingly, by the way, the editor and chief of The Lancet, Richard Horton, was there, and he wrote about that, my talk. But within the talk, you know, of 1,000 people, there was a small group, you know, probably single figures, people who started shouting halfway through.
You have naysayers.
Who basically, yeah, well, no. Well, the interesting thing is, this is the irony of all of this. They were accusing me of being controlled opposition. So apparently I'm working for Pfizer secretly and getting the information out. Mm-hmm. And there is no virus, and I need to apologize for promoting the vaccine, that kind of stuff. So that then descended into a bit of chaos initially, but yes. Then, you know, the overall majority of people there were there to support and to help, other people as well, and propagate the message that this is about transparency and honesty and having a discussion about where we are and the evidence for the vaccine. So, yeah, that was, and of course, you're going to, listen, Sam, there is going to be, of course, part of the backlash from industry. So one of the ways that big corporations exert their power, and they do it through several ways. They capture politicians and policymakers by lobbying. They capture the narrative, control of the media, quite often think tanks. They capture the knowledge environment by funding medical education or funding medical research. They capture the legal environment. You mentioned that already, you know, getting immunity from prosecution. And then there's something called the extra legal environment called opposition fragmentation. So what they do is, if there are people who are basically, pardon my language, Sam, calling out their bullshit, in the mainstream, they will try and discredit them and smear them because they don't want that conflict to reach into the mainstream discussion, because they know that they're not going to last very long, because people can see the truth quite quickly and who's being honest and who's not. So what they do is they smear and attack people's credibility. So some of this stuff that you read about is orchestrated from these big corporations. And what they do is they smear, they misrepresent stuff I've said, and they ignore the elephant in the room, Sam. And the elephant in the room is this, and no one's been able to counter this so far. If there's one study or one bit of data that is more than enough to suggest that this vaccine should never have been rolled out in the first place, it is a reanalysis of Pfizer and Moderna's own trials done by some of the most eminent scientists in the world. These are not novices. Robert Kaplan from Stanford, Peter Doshi, associate with the BMJ, Sander Greenland, who's considered the world's top epidemiologist. He wrote the textbook on epidemiology. And Joseph Framer, the lead author, I've got to know very well. They published a reanalysis of Pfizer and Moderna's trials in the journal Vaccine, peer-reviewed. And what they found at the very beginning, having looked at new data, the vaccine was more likely to cause you harm than good. So people, the risk of a serious adverse event, that means hospitalization, disability, life-changing event, was higher in the original trials than it was in terms of you being hospitalized with COVID. So for me, that suggests it shouldn't have been given to a single. Forget about mandates and coercion and kids, mate. We shouldn't even go there. It should never have been given to a single human in the first place. Now, the rate of serious adverse events is 1 in 800. That's probably an underestimate because it's just at 2 months. And of the highest proportion of those serious adverse events were related to clotting, Sam. So that means heart attacks, strokes, lung clots, right? And we've got lots of other data now supporting that this is what's happening. Lots of other, you know, we talk about what we call pharmacovigilance support. So that's reporting from the public and doctors. You've got observational different data showing that there's an increase in heart attacks and cardiac arrest in young people, which is associated with vaccine and not associated with COVID. You've got autopsy data. I've got my own clinical experience. Now, one of the things, and I think this is where we're leading to anyway, Sam, if you'd allow me just to carry on a little bit more. One of the things that most people, I was probably maybe one of the only people, the cardiologists in the world, that was able to determine this. And when I realized what was likely going to happen, it really worried me. My father, who was a very fit, healthy, 73-year-old guy, you know, he was vice president of the BMA. I come from a sporting family. He got into medical school through cricket scholarship. You know, he played with many members of the Indian cricket team. That's why I also actually had a passion for cricket. And we'll come to that, why I'm mentioning that in a second. So he was extremely fit. And then he suffered a sudden cardiac death in 6 months after he'd had two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. I organized a post-mortem because it didn't make sense to me. And his post-mortem findings showed two severe blockages out of three of his coronary arteries. Now, I didn't predict that. That again, didn't make any sense. He had no symptoms of what we call angina. So angina, Sam, is a symptom of chest discomfort you get when you're doing exertion. And often when patients get that and they present to their doctor, they'll get investigated and they'll find severe blockages. And in middle-aged and younger people, that's pretty consistent. Like, if you've got severe blockages, more times than not, it will come up in some of the symptoms. You'll get warnings of it, right? And you'll get investigated. So he didn't have any of those warning signs. That's one thing that was odd. Then he had severe blockages. There was no actual heart attack. And they said that he had probably reduction in blood flow to the heart. And then it caused what we call an arrhythmia, funny electrical disturbance, and causes cardiac arrest. And so for me, at that time, I couldn't make sense of it, Sam. Sorry, go on.
So Dr. Asim Malhotra, your contention, I think, is that the vaccine has deleterious effects on people's health, particularly sports people. Is that generally what you conclude about the vaccine?
Yes, mate. I think that what I would say is it actually has a potential adverse effect on the heart on anyone. In particular, well, there's two different mechanisms of harm to the heart that can cause a cardiac arrest. One is myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle, and that's slightly different to a heart attack. But what that can do is in athletes and young people, it can cause, you know, within a few weeks of the vaccine, you can get a funny rhythm disturbance and that can cause a cardiac arrest. But the other mechanism of harm for me, which is more disturbing, is what it does is if you've got any underlying mild furring of your heart arteries, and by the way, you know, coronary artery disease, the furring can start even in teenage years, even if you haven't got a good lifestyle. But most people don't present with heart attacks or problems with the heart to their doctor till after the age of 60, right? So this is something that takes decades to develop over years, where you get gradual buildup of furring of the arteries based upon different risk factors, you know, diabetes, poor diet related stuff, high blood pressure, smoking, an abnormal cholesterol profile, et cetera. So that can develop over years. And what happened, what my hypothesis, which I think has a lot of strong validity scientifically now, is that we have published research, research that's been published that shows that within just a few months of having the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, what happens is there are markers in the blood that are associated with inflammation of the heart artery. So heart disease is now considered what we call a chronic inflammatory condition. Anything that increases inflammation is going to cause more heart disease and more heart attacks. Now, what this research showed, published in Circulation November 2021, is that within just 2 months of having the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, someone's baseline risk of having a heart attack in 5 years jumped from 11% to 25% in 8 weeks, which is massive. And what that means, Sam, and other data supports this, is that the vaccine is accelerating the process of heart disease. So let's just say, for example, you're a 50-year-old guy. Let's just say you're a 50-year-old, two-year-old guy. Okay, let's get on. Let's just talk about it because it's hit the news anyway. Shane Warne. Now, I, like many Australians and many people around the world, was absolutely, distraught and gutted when Shane died. I know he was a personal friend of yours, so I know you've probably been affected a lot worse than most. The first thing to me was, as a cardiologist, as someone that, looks at patterns, I thought, first of all, this is odd. Shane's 52. He was an international sportsman. Fine, he'd retired. And fine, yes, I know that he didn't have the optimal lifestyle, but he was overweight and he smoked a bit. I know all that stuff, but it was still very odd for him to have a sudden cardiac death at 52. That's very unusual. So the first thing that came to my mind, I thought, what else is going on? What can be contributing to this? And I was in Australia and spoke to someone. I don't want to name them because I didn't want to be named, but someone extremely close to Shane, just to try and put all the pieces together in terms of the history and what happened. So I know that he had a couple of doses of the Pfizer vaccine in June and July of 2021. And then, of course, he died in March the following year. I also know that there was no significant underlying history, certainly of chest pains or anything else that was obvious. And certainly there was no investigation, I understand, that was highlighted. He wasn't any treatment for heart disease, as far as we know. And then the most odd thing, Sam, as well, which also fits for me in the fact that this is probably related to the vaccine, other than the acceleration of heart disease. Well, his post-mortem showed he had, severe blockages of heart arteries. We know that, which again, we'd think is a little bit unusual, is that Shane, as you know, Sam, was found essentially dead in the bed, right? When he was found unresponsive. So it was in the afternoon in this resort in Thailand. He'd not told anyone he had chest pain, right? So it was all very, very sudden. And for me, that all fits with a pattern that I'm seeing with other patients as well, is that people are having cardiac arrests with no warning. And some of them are surviving. They're lucky enough to be near a defibrillator and being resuscitated and taken to the operating theater. And they're looking at the arteries and finding severe blockages. But many are not, unfortunately. And because we know now, in my opinion, very clearly that the vaccine is accelerating heart disease in people with any even mild furrings, we are, and I knew this from 2021, we would continue to see, and hopefully it won't last for very long, but it might carry on for a few years, that people even a year or two having had the vaccine are going to suddenly present with a heart attack or a sudden cardiac death because the vaccine started that process.
Don? Can I ask you a philosophical question here, Asim? Now, I'm not medical, but I can relate to a couple of things that you've mentioned. One is the sugar in diets and also the cholesterol drugs. Now, I have got a problem with cholesterol, but consequently I had an adverse effect to the statin. So I did my own research, and I think you're pushing shit uphill, because cholesterol drugs were developed back in the 50s in America. There was an English professor or scientist or whatever it was, when these drugs were produced, he said the biggest problem is not cholesterol or fat or whatever, it's going to be sugar. Now, he was howled down. Now, that is back in the 1950s. We're 70 years down the track and the problems are still there. Now, I'll bring up the other one with regard to vaccines.
You're saying the doc has hard time promoting this theory.
Well, it
how do
you like get
you're disputing what
No,
you're
I'm
saying.
Not disputing what you're saying at all. All I'm saying is that you're pushing shit uphill trying to get your view across, because this has been around for 70 odd years. Now I'll get back to the vaccines. Now, my understanding as a layman is there's got to be a process with regard to the vaccines, and they take 7 or 10 years to be qualified as a vaccine, all the various
validated
tests. Yes. Now, these have been trotted out. We're getting new variants of COVID.
And how
do the vaccines keep up with that? When is the pub test come into play? And when are people or authorities going to wake up? Because it's just not making sense.
Absolutely right, mate. So I think a couple of things to say. One is, yeah, these things can unfortunately take time. But for me, you know, I also think you asked a philosophical question. When you speak the truth, you've got to let go of the outcome. Right. At the end of the day, we have to do what we think is right. We have to try and shift the dial so that we are behaving in a moral way. We are trying to do something that's good for society, because the society is going, unfortunately, it's shit uphill. Society is going downhill, man. It's going to shit right now. We're on a trajectory towards hell because we have less access to the truth. People's mental and physical health is declining. And I'm doing my best, and I think all of us want to do our best to try and shift that dial so we actually move more towards utopia. It is a difficult battle, but you know, certainly we've had some successes in the UK, you know, with the sugary drinks tax. I think the main issue now is ultra processed food, which is half of the British diet, 6% of the calories in the American diet. I suspect it's similar in Australia, and that should be treated like tobacco in a way, in the way that we managed to control tobacco. We had a victory with tobacco, mate, but you're right. It took 50 years from the first link between smoking and lung cancer were published in medical journals before effective regulation and public health education campaigns were introduced. So we've been here before. I think we just need to keep fighting on it. In terms of the vaccine stuff, my approach to this is quite simple. I genuinely believe most people want the truth. Most people are intrinsically good, and most people hate to see injustice, right? So what are we trying to do here through this conversation we're having right now, through every other medium, through conversations that people are having with each other, is make the injustice visible. And once people have access to the full truth, then ultimately we will do what is in the best interest for our mental and physical health. So that's what we're fighting here, mate. It is difficult, but I think we can win this. Certainly, I felt since my trip in Australia, with all the feedback I was getting from the Aussies and people coming to my talks, you know, we managed to hit the mainstream news, which I think was a big coup. I think there is a ripple effect happening. And I think Australia very, very quickly is going to get to the situation where the government is going to have no choice but to say these vaccines need to be suspended and there needs to be an investigation. Because people are going to stop taking them. People are going to just say no. They're not going to comply. We've got politicians in Australia now speaking up. We've got Brian Walker spoke in the Western Australian Parliament last night mentioning Shane Warne. I've met many people, people like, you know, Gerard Rennick and Malcolm Roberts, Alex Antic. You know, there are a lot of people now that are feeling empowered and courageous enough to speak out, and I think the public are going to go with them.
We should say, should we not, that your theory about the vaccine and its deleterious effect on Shane Warne, you say that many high-profile sports people have suffered as a result of the vaccine, not just Shane. Don't you?
Yes, mate. Well, the thing is, we know that there is, an increase in sudden cardiac death above the average. I haven't got the exact figures for you amongst athletes, but I think it's not just athletes, Sam. It's happening all across the world in every demographic and every age group. And in fact, actually, some of the evidence suggests that the age group that's the most increase in death is actually younger, middle-aged people. So there's something very, very odd happening. And the clear, obvious, you know, elephant in the room here is the vaccines. And, you know, Norman Fenton is a professor of risk, a very eminent professor of statistics in Queen Mary University in London. And his own analysis, just looking at the reporting rates of in America and the UK, of people saying that there's been an issue with the heart or sudden cardiac death linked to the vaccine, he suggested that half of all the excess deaths above average happening in the UK are likely because of the COVID vaccine. This is unbelievable, mate. Unbelievable.
It is. That's an unbelievable statistic. If correct, it is correct. If you say it is. You mentioned Saturn.
Well, likely. Yes. Let's be honest. Yeah, likely. It's certainly a signal that needs to be looked into.
You mentioned satins, which I wasn't aware of what a satin was. Is that fluid reduction in diet?
Statin.
Is it?
Statin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Statins. I'm sorry. Statins. I beg your pardon. Is that fluid reduction? What is statins?
statins, mate, are a cholesterol-lowering drug, and certainly prior to the pandemic, one of the most lucrative drugs in the history of medicine. In fact, your colleague and friend there mentioned the statin issue and taking and getting side effects. It's a $1 trillion industry. So that also means that if someone's going to challenge their prescription, you're going to get attacked. And I went through all of that. But I'm not for saying don't take statins. What I talk about, you know, what I promote, what is at the heart of everything I do is what we call, it may sound strange concept for a lot of people, Sam. It's called ethical, evidence-based medical practice. So what does that mean? Let's just break it down in numbers forms. If you haven't had a heart attack and you haven't got diagnosis of severe blockages in your arteries, which is most people, then the benefit of a statin over a 5-year period, when you break down the numbers, is about 1 in 100 at best. That means there's a 1% chance it will prevent you having a non-fatal heart attack or a non-disabling stroke, but will not prolong your life. Now, in keeping with the principles of ethical evidence-based medical practice and informed consent, patients should be told this. And this is something I've written about. I coordinate a campaign with the BMJ and the Medical Royal Colleges. Even the World Health Organization, can you believe it, in 2009, said it's an ethical imperative that information is conveyed to patients in this way. But most doctors are not doing it, not because they are deliberately wanting to mislead patients. Doctors themselves are misinformed. It's partly a culture and conditioning that we don't explain information to patients in a way that they can understand. And then what happens is I will tell that to my patient and they will say, doc, you know, they might say, oh, I don't want to take that pill. That doesn't sound very good. And I'll say, I support your decision. Or they may say, I'll take a chance. I'll take it. And then you get into discussion. They'll say, well, what else can I do if I want to reduce my heart disease risk? And I'll say, well, listen, if you sort your diet out, and I'll give them a prescription of the diet, and you start doing a bit of exercise, don't be sedentary, right? Even just a 30-minute brisk walk every day, sort your sleep and stress out, I'll tell them, you can probably combat 80% of heart disease just from those lifestyle changes, and you don't have to worry about side effects.
Well, now, Doc, on diets, you've written a fairly controversial book, I think, called The Pioppy Diet. And it was challenged. I think, was that fair to say? It was a pretty controversial, yeah. The Pioppy, yeah. Which is basically a Mediterranean diet, which consists of, is it basically Mediterranean diet and consists of what and why, yeah, is it so controversial?
Yeah, mate, to be honest, you know, first, one of the reasons it's controversial is I'm basically telling people that the best way to having a healthy diet is to cut out junk food. I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but that's exactly how it. But they framed it basically saying, so what is the diet plan? It takes the components of the Mediterranean diet, which have been shown through multiple bits of research to be beneficial through having anti-inflammatory properties. So the other side of heart disease, as well as, you know, I told you before, it's chronic inflammation. So to combat that, obviously one of the antidotes is stuff that's anti-inflammatory. That means things like extra virgin olive oil, oily fish, nuts and seeds, whole fruit and vegetables, right? Apparently very controversial, Sam, yeah? Eating, yeah, those foods. Yeah. The thing that was really controversial was I said that to do this effectively for heart disease prevention, the best diet plan is to remove refined sugars and carbohydrates. So that means minimizing or eliminating, depending on where you are. If you're already like overweight and you're pre-diabetic or something, then you have to go more extreme, right? But basically eliminating foods like bread, pasta, rice, potatoes. And that will optimize your what we call metabolic health. And metabolic health is really optimal metabolic health basically means that you are in a state where you have lowest levels of body fat. Your body fat percentage is in the ideal range. And that is manifested through things like blood pressure and diabetes and waist circumference and a cholesterol profile. So this is the best diet plan to improve those markers, which doesn't involve taking drugs. And that's why it was called controversial. But the people who were naming it controversial, surprise, surprise, Sam, were people funded by the food industry. The food industry who make their money by selling people junk and ultra-processed food that get them addicted, that, you know, improves their profit margins, why people get sick. Now, so that's the upshot of the controversy around it, Sam, to be honest.
Good. Now, this is Ivan, who's been sitting here listening to this attentively.
Trying to get a word in.
No, you're getting now, one now.
Now, Doc, you're there in the UK. Now, fast food, is that cheaper in the UK to buy than, say, the Mediterranean diet?
Yeah, mate, you know, it's a good point. So in general, it is easier to and cheaper to eat junk than it is to eat healthy food.
Yep,
and that's why one of the things I propagate and I say this is, you know, why the government has a role to play here is that what they need to do is make healthy food more affordable. And and I know this is a controversial area, but it worked with tobacco. I mean, it's taxing ultra-processed food. So I told this to Joe Rogan on his podcast, and he was pretty shocked by this. The biggest healthcare breakthrough in the Western world in the last 50 years was taxing cigarettes, because that had the biggest impact on driving down tobacco consumption, which was reduction in tobacco consumption, certainly, you know, from, say, 1970s, 1980s, certainly through to 2010. Was responsible for a 50% reduction in death rates from heart disease. It was the biggest impact. And the single biggest intervention was taxing cigarettes. So what I would say is, yeah, we tax ultra-processed food, make healthy food more affordable. But I think it's also about, you know, there's other issues as well. I think our culture has changed a little bit. People like to eat on the go. Certainly the British lunch hour has gone, where, you know, people used to sit down and eat with their friends and have a lunch break or whatever else, or with their colleagues. People are eating fast food on the go at their desks in their offices in 15 minutes. Yep. So all of these things also contribute to the consumption of unhealthy foods, mate.
So, Doc, of the many strings to your bow, what is the main aim of your advocacy or tutelage, if you could leave your public that you speak to? Is it diet? Is it the vaccine? What is your main aim to get across to the people you speak to? Be wary of the vaccine?
Yeah, listen, right now, I think people, there are two areas that I think are most important. Certainly we can, I think the message to people is, and I see this in my patients, changing diet has a rapid effect on your health and your markers for disease, even within, you know, a 3 or 4 weeks. If you go strict on, and you don't have to count calories, by the way, so you basically, I would say, go on a sort of low refined carbohydrate Mediterranean diet, whatever else, you will see massive improvements to your health markers, but also quality of life. People say they get better mental clarity, better energy, better sleep, that kind of thing. And the other side right now, I think the biggest public health scandal issue, and I said this to Dan Wootton, who's an Australian journalist that works for GB News, in September when he interviewed me on my paper. I said, in relation to this COVID vaccine, guys, we are literally dealing with the greatest miscarriage of medical science, damage to population health, attack on democracy that we will witness in our lifetime. What is going on right now shouldn't be underestimated. It is truly, truly horrific. The establishment that are carrying, pushing on this message are dealing with a combination of commercial influence, big pharma over them, but also willful blindness. So a lot of them, people are indoctrinated so much into this belief that it's safe and effective that they are turning a blind eye to the facts. And we have to have empathy for those people that aren't fully on board yet, and understand a lot of the barriers to this discussion. And this has happened with friends and family, Sam. You know, friends and families have fallen out of this.
It's a psychological barrier. I don't know if this is for public consumption, but Don, when you mention something, is signaling, word mouthing to me, about, this is not for public consumption, Don. What were you going to say when mentioned something?
Well, I'd just like to... I was wishing to change the subject, but if you've got something else to continue on with, I'll come in a little bit later, Doc.
Doc, I'm only partially educated, as you've probably worked out by now. I still don't know what statins are. Could you tell me what is a statin?
What would we know it as?
A drug that lowers cholesterol. So it might be atorvastatin, Lipitor.
Yeah, Lipitor, and it has an ad. It has an adverse effect upon the body. You have aches and pains and whatever else, and
it doesn't cause life-threatening events. But it can cause muscle aches and fatigue.
Exactly.
And then a lot of people think, exactly.
Right. Now, listen, so just on a lighter note,
from left field, this is it, and this is it.
You said you were a crit. You there?
Yeah, mate. Absolutely.
Now, just on a lighter note, I couldn't watch the cricket. did you watch the cricket, and what do you think of Bazball?
Mate, I love cricket. I watched it. By the way, just on that note, one of the other reasons I had a personal kind of extra regard for Shane Warne, I had to decide between cricket and medicine at one stage in my career. I was selected for Lancashire under 16 Centre of Excellence. I played for a school called Manchester Grammar, which is a cricketing school. And I became a leg spinner because of Warney, literally. He inspired me to go. And I was pretty good, mate. I was pretty good. So... I just wanted to mention that in there.
So what do you think of the cricket now?
Oh, mate, I loved watching the first test yesterday. I'll be honest with you, my British friends aren't going to be very happy about this. I've got a soft corner for you guys.
Well, I
certainly enjoyed watching the game at first, put it that way.
Well, I'm not a good loser, but they certainly have turned, and they're questioning convention, the English, and I congratulate them, because they're just doing something that you wouldn't even think would happen on the cricket field.
Yep, Yeah. What is that exactly, Sam?
Well, the point is...
Don, I have no idea what he's talking about.
Well, I mean, the field settings that Stokes had done, the umbrella field, oh, yeah. The way Root came out and hooked the ball over the first ball of the whole match, which was hit by four, coming, you know, taking their block, you know, not halfway down the wicket, but a fair way out of their crease. I mean, they've just... How the Australia? I just thought it was riveting cricket.
Oh, absolutely, and it's interesting. The Aussies didn't play what they're usually
exactly
very attacking,
exactly.
And it was much more circumspect. It was kind of, you know, probably from the textbook of Don Bradman, mate. To be honest, a bit more circumspect, proper cricket.
Now, Dr. Asim Malhotra, we do thank you on behalf of Ivan and Don Scott and myself. We do thank you very much for joining us on You Cannot Be Serious. If someone doesn't get something interesting out of that, they're not fair dinkum. So thank you so much for joining us from the UK, and we wish you well.
Thank you, guys. All the best. Lots of love.
Having a bad day with the sound, forgot to actually put the microphone up, Don, to show that Daddy Cool is singing the end of this.